Well, welcome everybody. We are finishing up this Digestible Jung series with a discussion of really the implications of what we've talked about so far. My basic thesis throughout all these workshops was that was Jung's discovery, really, that the unconscious has a guiding function. Dreams and images from the unconscious have a capacity of showing us how our life can most richly evolve. His first formulation of that, I'm just sort of summarizing now everything we've done in about 3 minutes, was that the ego has to fight the resistance to going into the unconscious. That was the hero myth. And once it gets into the images of the unconscious, those images will guide. And that's true sometimes, but as time went on, he realized it was a little too simplistic for many of the experiences we have with the dreams. And that is that sometimes the unconscious images don't guide us. And the ego has to take another step to set it up so that the guiding aspect of the unconscious can come to life. And that's what we've been working on. And he presented a couple of different models. The one is the alchemical model, in which the ego has to recognize conflict and carry its conflict. That's all this business of the opposites. So that the guiding aspect of the unconscious only comes to life after we have grappled with, suffered over, and endured pairs of opposites that we discover in this inner journey. That was the alchemical model. The ion model is that the ego has to withdraw projections, that the creative aspect of the unconscious doesn't come into play until the ego is actively involved with withdrawing projections. Another model that we talked about was what I called the Job model, that guiding aspect of the unconscious doesn't come into play until the ego is confronted with a hostile reaction from the unconscious and stands its ground. Once it stands its ground, then the unconscious turns positive and begins to guide. The other main idea we talked about is all of this stuff seen from a historical perspective. I won't review that, but the basic thesis, again, the guiding aspect of the unconscious, often the ego has to take certain steps to activate that guiding aspect of the unconscious. The main image that emerges as a guiding image is what Jung calls the self. That's what we're talking about today. What are the implications of that self-image, which is the personification of the guidance of the unconscious? That self-image often is depicted in imagery that is very close to traditional representations of God. So as soon as you get into the self, which is the image of guidance, you are thrust into a discussion of religious issues, because that image of the self is very often a religious image. For example, it might just be an image of God, or an image of goddess, or it might have characteristics that we know from the history of religions are attributed to God, multiples of four, circles, images of great value, like the pearl of great price. We talked about that really the very, very, very first thing we did here, so I won't go into that. I just wanted to establish the basic working hypothesis today, that the self-image, which is generated, as we've talked about, through this struggle between the ego and the unconscious, often has as attributes of its symbolism images of divinity or characteristics of divinity. So as soon as we get into talking about the self, we are faced with religious symbolism. And that evokes and has implications for our understanding of what religion is. So one of the things we're going to be talking about today is how does Jung understand the self as a God image, and what implications does that put to us for how we understand religion? So the first theme we'll be looking at is Jung's understanding of religion, as it comes out of the implications that the self-image is depicted in... Somebody's here. I think she might actually have a key. I think she's a doctor. The image of... hello? Because the self-image is expressed in images of God, that leads Jung to reevaluating what is religious experience and what is the nature of religion. So, first main theme today is the nature of religion coming out of his reflections on the self. The other phenomenon that tends to occur when the self is activated is synchronicity. We'll talk about what synchronicity is. You probably basically know it's this coincidence between an inner event, inner psychological event, a dream image, and an outer real physical happening. So examining the guiding aspect of the self not only brings us into a discussion of what the nature of religion is, it also brings us into a discussion, what's the nature of matter? How can the material world act symbolically? So it likewise poses a challenge to our understanding of what science is. So that will be the second theme we'll be talking about today. How does Jung's work on the phenomenology of the self get him questioning the nature of the scientific method and the nature of the material world, which is the object of the scientific method? And in that, of course, he was helped a great deal in discussions with the Nobel laureate Wolfgang Pauli. So Pauli and Jung will also be involved. So two main themes today. Because of the phenomenology of the self touches on God, we'll be talking about religion. And because synchronicity is such a common occurrence at certain points when the self is activated, we'll be talking about the nature of matter and the methodology for investigating matter, namely science. That is our agenda for today. I have no idea how long this is going to take. We may get through it in a couple of hours. We may need the whole day. But we will take a break in any way about every hour or so, however long we go. So we'll take a break this morning for coffee and chit-chat, and then we're sharing a lunch from 12 to 1, and then if we still need more time, we'll come back in the afternoon and talk about the remainder of the problem. So I've given you a list. I tried to go through, not a list, a study guide, really. I tried to go through Jung's collected works and pick out the most important quotes I could find on these two issues, the nature of religion coming out of himself, and the nature of matter and science. And I've given you an outline. It might not hurt to go over the outline, and then we'll dive into it. The first thing we're going to talk about is Jung's epistemological criticism, which is based on Kant. In other words, before we can talk about what religious knowledge is, we have to spend a little time examining what is knowledge. So that's what we'll start us off. Then the next part on religion, we'll talk about what Jung calls the continuing incarnation. And I think, you know, it's hard to say these things with sufficient nuance. But in a way, I think Jung was trying to see how the future of religion might evolve and whether his discoveries would have any bearing on that. Then the next part, we'll look at the relationship between science and psychology. We'll take a very brief look at quantum mechanics and how that would be what Wolfgang Pauli brought to the discussion. How quantum mechanics and synchronicity really have certain features in common, or at least potentially in common. So that what Jung was discovering about synchronicity, he felt quantum mechanics was in an analogous way discovering about matter. That raises a big question, which is, where is the symbol creating function in us? If synchronicities are symbolic and synchronicities occur outside the personality, then the symbol-creating agency is obviously not only something inside us, but it's outside us. That forced Jung to reevaluate his concept of archetype. Conversely, it puts a challenge to science, which Pauli recognizes that science has no way of explaining synchronicity. And Pauli thought, as a good scientist, that was not the problem of synchronicity, that was the problem of science, and that science in the future would develop a model which was capable of understanding these phenomena, that the material world is somehow psychic and that the psychic world is somehow material. A little bit about Pauli's understanding of the scientific imagination, and then the last point there, F. Are we in the middle of a genesis of a new worldview? So that's our agenda today. And then I'd be giving you some miscellaneous quotes that we can turn to. So this is supposed to be a seminar, so, you know, speak up unless we have a raving extrovert. I'll ask everybody to cooperate. Can I share the space? And hopefully we have a good discussion. So that's really the point of this stuff. It is controversial, and it's probably upsetting. But I find it very interesting. Okay, let's go to the first quote there. The main sources, I've given you all the sources, are Jung's letters. And that's where Jung discusses his final theological views. Volume 2 of the letters. Edward Edinger has done a fantastic job reading all of those letters, which are not easy, and summarizing them in his book, The New God Image. So he kind of takes the reader through the meat of Jung's thoughts in those letters. Psychology, religion, but comes in there, but mostly the letters and Edinger. Okay, so here we go. I think this is probably the single most important paragraph Jung wrote on religion. And hopefully I can make its meaning clear to you. It's a letter. Many thanks for your friendly letter, he's writing back, which shows that the Buber-Jung controversy is a serious matter for you. And so indeed it is. For here that threshold which separates two epochs plays the principal role. I mean, I think that's the first dynamite word, separates two epochs. The point of view that Jung is putting forward, he feels is brand new, and it is a break with Western tradition. I mean that threshold, the theory of knowledge, whose starting point is Kant. On that threshold, minds go their separate ways, those who have understood Kant and those that cannot follow him. So what Jung is saying is there is a basic shift in human consciousness that's going on, and you either get it or you don't get it. And if you are able to make that shift in consciousness, it is the foundation for reevaluating everything we've ever said about religion. And I think Jung would say it's preparing the way for a new religious attitude. What's the theory? Putting it very simply, Kant distinguishes between religious experience and religious knowledge. The argument goes something like this. An ant can never know me.
Never know what?
Me. The nervous system of an ant isn't sufficiently complex for it to understand my personality. That is a distance from the very small to the very large. When we talk about God, we're talking about the shift from the finite to the infinite. If an ant cannot know me out of that order of magnitude, how could an individual know God out of that order of magnitude? It is humanly impossible that a human being can know what God is. That is Kant and Jung's position. So that statements about God may have nothing to do with God at all. statements about God are statements about our experience of God. That Jung accepts. But he doesn't accept that that statement is a true knowledge of the infinite. That knowledge is impossible. In other words, there is no such thing as metaphysical knowledge. So you simply cannot say, God told me to do this. You can say, I had the experience that God told me to do this. But how do you know that is actually what God said? So it puts psychology and religion on equal footing. Jung says the only method that's open to us is the investigation of religious experience. He never doubts that there is a God, but that the statements of God that we make are more about us than about God. Yeah.
This takes me back to the whole concept of Buddhism. And Buddhism says it's about experience. You know, read the Buddhist work. It's truly about, don't trust us. Read it if you want, but you come out of your own experience. So it's really a personal experience factor. But the Buddhists have a tendency to kind of really not look well on you. And I don't understand that, and I don't know if you do that. Is it the misinterpretation down through the ages of people that took Jung and tried to, didn't do the experience, but tried to have that knowledge or that knowing, that metaphysical knowing?
My problem is I don't know what Buddhism is, because I studied this stuff in the 70s, and I got one impression. And I look at the Dalai Lama, and I get another impression. If there is a world transcendence in Buddhism, that's what Jung would argue against. I don't know whether that's old Buddhism or whether the Dalai Lama is actually redefining Buddhism. He certainly is not interested in transcending the world if he takes apart clocks and cars.
He's interested in science.
And he's very interested in science.
And he's interested in that bridge.
And he's interested in that bridge.
You know, which is what you're interested in.
I think I don't think I can give you an intelligent answer. I don't know what Buddhism is anymore. And I wonder if it itself is in a process of transformation.
I would agree.
Yeah.
It's the difference between sitting, doing Krishna time, and understanding it from that aspect of going internally and having an inner experience and then coming back out and replaying what the material world is talking about.
In general, as we'll see, Jung feels we cannot give any priority to any religious tradition. So that might irritate somebody.
Yeah, but it's still the personal inner experience.
Yeah, if you are speaking strictly of personal inner experience, I don't see how Jung would be in conflict.
No, I don't see a conflict.
No.
That's one in one, there is.
No, I don't know.
There's a book that compares Jungian psychology and Tibetan Buddhism, and Lama Yeshe, who came to Western in the 70s, had this book written because he thought there were many useful parallels.
Yeah. I think there are clearly many useful parallels, without a doubt. Well, you got the basic idea. No such thing as metaphysical knowledge. See, I'm not going to repeat, Janice.
No, I can hear you, what you just said.
Metaphysical knowledge.
Okay.
If you can't get here on time, you lose. Let me give you an example, which Nancy pointed out to me, of a dialogue between Joseph Campbell and Martin Buber. Jung refers to the Buber-Jung controversy. That might be a good place just to get a feeling practically for how this works. Buber, as sort of a, you know, Buber was a Jewish theologian. He wrote I and Thou, which actually is a very beautiful book. He accused Jung of psychologizing religion. This is the attack that you will hear from the theological side to my statement that there's no such thing as metaphysical knowledge. What they're saying is, Jung, you just take religious experience and you turn it into psychology. And as we've seen, that it's like two arguments crossing in at perpendicular angles, because Jung is saying there is no such thing as metaphysical knowledge. And how that works out practically is a very interesting vignette on page 6, the very last quote. There is a brief but interesting dialogue I had with Martin Buber when he was in New York in 1954. He was lecturing at Columbia, and I raised my hand and said, "There's a word being used here this evening that I don't understand." He said, "What's the word?" I said, "God." He said, "You don't understand what God means?" He replied. I said, "I don't know what you mean by God. You've told us that God has hidden his face, that we are in exile. I've just come from India, where people are experiencing God all the time." And you know what Buber said? "Do you mean to compare?" You see, the religious tradition thinks its experience of God is a knowledge of God superior to other traditions. And what Jung is trying to do is circumvent that danger. Buber was a Hasidic rabbi. And actually, Jung took a fair amount from his work, I and Thou, in his essay on transference. I think Buber has a lot to say. But it's this tragic point where the psychologists and theologians just can't communicate. Buber would say, "You are psychologizing God, Jung, but you see the arrogance of the point of view that doesn't accept that there's a psychological relativity to their own experience of God." So that's where Jung is coming from, to try and avoid that inability to compare experience with equal validity. And we'll go on and look at the implications of that. So that's really the basic point.
So you said that the traditional religions in general, they're saying their metaphysical knowledge of God is better than if someone has a psychological experience of God.
Well, yeah, I would just phrase it a little differently. They would say their experience of God is knowledge of God. That's the way God is. So what you say about what the way God is wrong. It leads to an arrogance, a certainty, which Jung feels is a great error.
That's what Bill Mayer's movie is all about.
I haven't seen it, no.
Great. Quite a stunning piece of work.
Yeah.
So knowledge means certainty.
Well, yeah, that, you know, if I know you, then I presume that what I'm experiencing of you is what you are. And experience allows me to say, well, this is what I'm perceiving of you. Is that who you are? Now, it's easier in a human relationship to get that clear. But there's no way of getting that clear between the finite and infinite.
But, I mean, this is a question for later. But science says that what they know is the extent of their knowledge, and it's not the ultimate truth necessarily, because they're still looking for that, you know, they don't know.
Well, we're going to see, I think, a convergence between religion and science.
Yeah, so it's that knowledge thing, the certainty or the surety of knowledge. That's a huge question.
That's the big question. That is the big question. And I just wanted to, you know, just really lay it out why that's so important and why Jung refuses to accept statements of God as certainties, which, you know, infuriates theologians. Then they call that psychologizing religion. But it is really a fundamental shift in understanding. That's why I went to the trouble of reading this paragraph and emphasizing separates two epochs. Jung really feels we're at a shift in world consciousness.
This quote right here, talking about?
Yes. Right.
Do you believe in God?
Yes. You know, yeah, go ahead and look at that.
Thank you. I know.
Yeah. Well, but read the next one. That's a good follow-up. Page 6 in the BBC interview that a man named John Freeman gave Jung in 1959, I think it was. Jung was 2 or 3 years away from his death. He was asked, "Do you believe in God? You see where I am?" Jung says, "Now, difficult to answer, I know, I don't need to believe, I know." And so he, of course, got a deluge of letters on that one. And here's his response. "Mr. Freeman, in his characteristic manner, fired the question, so I was perplexed and had to say the next thing which came into my mind. As soon as the answer had left the edge of my teeth, I knew I had said something controversial, puzzling, or even ambiguous. Mind you, I didn't say there is a God. I said, I don't need to believe in God I know, which does not mean I know a certain God, Zeus, Allah, Zeus, Yahweh, Allah, the Trinitarian God, but rather I do know that I am obviously confronted with a factor unknown in itself, which I call God." Translated, that means which in the consensus of all, everywhere, consensus of all, always, everywhere, and by everyone is believed. I remember him, I evoke him whenever I use his name, overcome by anger or by fear, whenever I voluntarily say, oh God. This happens when I meet somebody or something stronger than myself. It is an apt name given to all overpowering emotions in my own psychic system, subduing my own conscious will and usurping control over myself. This is a name by which I designate all things which cross my willful path," and so on. He says, no, I think he would really probably rather have said, for me, God isn't a matter of belief, it's a matter of experience, or it's a matter of cognition.
He knows because of experience.
He knows because of experience, yeah. That what he's trying to get away from is belief. And in working with folks' dreams, it doesn't matter what they believe in, it matters what are these images doing in their psyche. That's what interests Jung. And how are these images guiding them? How do we help people apprehend where the images are guiding them? And then help them move forward through that. So the way I've tried to put it, he replaces metaphysical certainty with ethical obligation. The point, we can't ever know whether that is God, but we do know it's a very highly important emotional experience to you. How can we help you follow its directives? And that, you might say, but that doesn't satisfy my need to believe. And Jung would say, your need to believe belongs to the last epoch. That is a need which we are now capable of surpassing. Yeah.
I'm wondering, my sense of the, when you talk about theologians, these are the religions of the book, of monotheism. And isn't, to me, monotheism seems to be an attempt to control God. And I'm wondering, do people really have a need to, particularly in that, do people really have a need to believe, or do they have a need to try to control?
Might be the same thing. That's certainly what Jung is trying to get away from, that I think my experience defines the thing, which is very convenient because it always happens that my experience is generally supportive of my values, even if they're wrong. So all this does is perpetuate an error. Some of you have heard me say this, bear with me, but when we invaded Iraq, both Bush and Blair said, I know from prayer God is directing us to fight these people in Iraq. And they found journals of fleeing Al-Qaeda which said, Allah told me to fight the United States. That's the problem. That experience is a valid experience, but then it's a period at the end of the sentence and no questioning takes place. Yeah.
Isn't it also a belief by other people of that experience that somebody else had? It's just a flat belief that what they said or what they wrote in the religious text are what their personal experience would be or is or is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And in reality, maybe that person that's writing that or saying that is truly coming from their own experience.
Yeah.
And that it gets put down and gets solidified.
And we'll see in a second. What it does, it perpetuates a childish attitude on the point of view of the believer, taking that other experience as a parent. So it sets up a one up, one down. And what Jung is trying to do is establish an adult relationship to this experience.
You know, Gary, that's such an interesting idea, because my understanding of all of this is that mythologically, this was a helpful point of view for people who were experiencing the vagaries of life thousands of years ago. I mean, they were in these unknown forces, and they were trying to figure out how to participate with them. And so in the midst of that, they began to develop stories about them.
Right.
So, and as they could see things repeating, they developed stories that helped them to see these images repeating. And gradually, then, they began to take shape through these sacred texts, which were the imaginative understanding of the prophets and the people that were writing about this back then. So originally it served a particular purpose for that state of consciousness that then has transferred into the 21st century, where we, after the 17th century when the whole Enlightenment period happened, and now we split nature, and so that whole nature idea that it needs to try to control, which goes back to Genesis point, they were trying to help control these.
That's very important. Everyone get that? And I probably should emphasize that. We talked about this in Ion a little bit. That's why Jung talks about two epochs. The first epoch, from the birth of Christianity up to now, you can see the importance of the parent-child, you might say, relationship. You can see that psychologically this had its reason for being. But now the nature of human consciousness and the demands of the time are requiring a different point of view. That's why Jung says two epochs. I think it's very important. He's never criticizing the way things have been, but saying, let's look at where they are now, how must they change into the future? Yeah, Martin.
Isn't it that uncertainty? They try to control it, they try to understand.
They try to participate.
Well, they were participating.
By telling stories.
We're participating in the market right now. And we're trying to make sense of something that we have no understanding of. But each on our own level is trying to take it in and say, what do I need to do to make it through this place of uncertainty? So
you guys are hitting deep questions very quickly. I would say that the error of the first epoch for our time is that generalized experience has come to substitute for individual experience. The challenge of our time is that individual religious experience can be the focus of your religious life, not a canonical religious experience. Now, Jung was discussing that, and let's hold off on this until we get to the second part, but I can at least allude to it now. Somebody asked him, but religion has always been a matter of the symbol, and you're talking about a symbol. You follow the difference? My experience, your experience, your experience, your experience, your experience. Whatever happened to general communal experience? And Jung said, we're not ready for that now. We are in a position of leaving the state where general experience substituted for individual experience. You might say a general symbol substituted for individual symbols. Maybe the ultimate goal of this second epoch is to recover a living, working general symbol, but we will only get there as individuals discover their symbol and come into dialogue with them. Again, I say that because the theologians will hammer away. The word is solipsistic, you know that word, that Jung's religion is solipsistic, meaning sort of just all wrapped up in yourself.
Solipsist.
And he's saying, it is that way, not because I say it should be that way, but that's the needs of the historical time. And the old myth is breaking down. We are probably in the process of generating a new myth. We don't know exactly where that's going to go. But the way we're going to get there is the synthesis of individual symbols. And that's why, again, he comes back to the importance of your experience as your vehicle for this period of history. So you can see that his argument is very much historically conditioned. And the next quote, again, says pretty much the same thing, slightly different way. There's a big old typo there. It should be, I approach psychological matters from a scientific and not from a philosophical standpoint. Inasmuch as religion has a very important psychological aspect, I deal with it from a purely empirical point of view. That is, I restrict myself to the observation of phenomena and I eschew any metaphysical or philosophical considerations. In other words, what he's interested in is, what is that religious imagery doing in your dreams? Not, does that tell us about the nature of God? So that he can study the dreams of a Buddhist, he can study the dreams of a Muslim, of a Christian, of a Native American, and he grants all of those images equal validity, because he's examining what's your relationship to the image. He's not looking at what of any metaphysical world does that image refer to. Because, by definition, we can't know it. The next paragraph gives us, I think, now it's a term we've been sort of dancing around, but it gives us a new vocabulary. Well, this is Ettinger summing up these two previous paragraphs. Jung's epistemology. You all know the word epistemology? Science of knowledge, theory of knowing. Jung's epistemology obviously corresponds to Kant's epistemology. That is, there's no such thing as metaphysical knowledge. Jung recognizes Kant's position is the threshold which separates two epochs. Hopefully that should be burned into your brain by now. It is a statement which, like lightning, lights up a whole landscape. Before Kant, humanity had been identified with its subjective experience. That's the blockbuster phrase, to be identified with your subjective experience. See, Buber was identified with his subjective experience. Follow that. You take your subjective experience as objectively true. To disidentify from your subjective experience is to say, oh, that's my experience of God. Mr. Hindu, what's your experience of God? And my experience of God has no greater claim to authority than your experience of God. So he's really, hopefully you can step back and see what Jung is really trying to do is prepare us for a religion of world community. You can't have a religion, you can't have world community if everybody's God is telling them to kill the other person's God. But by saying, oh, that is our experience of it, you open it up for dialogue.
Many names to call God, and so you could refer an experience to a particular kind of energy, where now we have a single word, and everybody has the experience and we talk about it as God, because
right.
It's the biggest thing we
yeah.
can. We can't think of anything that goes beyond that.
And just try to talk to anyone who's a marginal believer and question their grasp of God, you will be accused of blasphemy. These things, if you are identified with your subjective experience and under this general term of God and truth, discussion stops.
It's challenging because it's a single word that's a difficult way to have a conversation when you have a single word to call.
Well, it's impossible, I think.
So many things.
It's impossible.
Well, unless you have the capacity to open it up to the idea that it's better to
Yeah.
And then it becomes a very reasonable
right.
thing to think about.
Yeah. Just think, what are the major world conflicts today? Around what different groups experience their God to be telling them.
Wasn't this sense of openness to other experiences what was present when there was paganism? I mean, people would go, you call it this and I call it this. So that was one of the reasons why people didn't have to kill the other person's God. They could have sorted it. So why did we change from that point of view to the unitary point of view, which seems to have made us less open? What was the
I don't know enough about paganism to go ahead.
The challenge was, back then, they could talk about different gods and swords, but they were conquering. People were absorbing tribes and civilizations into one another. So in the Celtic tradition, for example, all they did was to absorb the pagan images into Christianity. And then people could begin, so those transitions very slowly took place over time.
Now I'm talking about how, when before Christianity developed,
That's the whole point. So it started way back then, as groups were moving around, and there was all this shaping of cultures and civilizations. There was actual warring going on, and so when somebody would take over another tribe, take them over, they would just simply absorb their tradition into the tradition of the conquering tribe.
Okay.
There was already a relationship of power.
So there's always a relationship there, exactly.
Yeah.
And the other thing was, back then, the imagery was often nature-based. It was all nature-based. And so, they call it this, but they understood it as this, and then they said, oh, I get that. It's just like marrying with an easy accretion for a lot of traditions.
Well, I understand that. What I'm saying is, why then, if we had that capacity to be able to do that, why did we end up with a single God? Because it sounds like what you're talking about, that we now have to honor other people's experiences. Like, we're going back to something we had.
It was for a political reason, because when monotheism came in, it was a hugely political issue, that if you were going to have all these disparate groups of people coming together, they needed a single God. They could not propitiate varying styles. And so you can see the whole history of monotheism is a complete march, a parallel march with the development of culture.
Okay.
And that was the easiest way to bring people together within a single image. You'll have no false gods before me, so a single God would take over and everybody would worship that one God. Then they wouldn't fight among themselves.
Let me just back up a second. Remember what I said earlier, that this is a historical discussion. And I think I would just broaden what Nancy said a little bit the first epoch was about power. Whether you look at political power, establishing of firm national boundaries, right or wrong, or whether you look at it as the growth of the power of the individual to control themselves. And again, Jung is not arguing that that was a meaningless historical process. We needed to develop that power. But now the presence of that power has become counterproductive and destructive. And how do we move to different nation, national identities and different personal identities where the dominant value isn't power, but something else? And I think that's this shift in two epochs. As you can see with the Buber Campbell dialogue, that was pure power. I say it, and therefore it is, and you have to be subservient to it. And that is the nature of a personality who is metaphysically certain. Valid for a time because human ego was so weak. But now the human ego, at least in theory, is has achieved a strength. So that another value besides power has to become the object of our inquiry. How are we going to live together, you might say. That question brought about by the nuclear danger and by just the world shrinking in terms of media means that power can no longer be the dominant value. So it also has a very practical reason for saying these things.
In Russia, one of the czars actually interviewed all the different world religions he could find at that time and made a political decision, this is the one we're going to choose to unite our country. And then he came to the law of the land that this will be our religion, the Russian Orthodox Church. He liked the Greek Orthodox Church better than the others.
So let me just finish that paragraph then. Before Kant, humanity had been identified with its subjective experience. After Kant, if one is able to see what he points out, one is no longer able to be identified with his subjective experience. One is now conscious of the subjectivity of the experience and therefore no longer can grant it metaphysical validity. Now if you know, if the word metaphysical validity sounds highfalutin, just put in there, can no longer say, I'm right, you're wrong. Which, of course, is the basis of a power relationship. And now the Jung says the same thing in the next quote. My human limitation does not permit me to assert that I know God, hence I cannot but regard all assertions about God as relative because subjectively conditioned. In other words, the perceiver in having an experience of God, his psyche is what is shaping that experience. So that the experience of God is a statement of the psyche of the perceiver. Does that make sense? Now, I think what I was saying about the social background of these ideas, and this out of respect for my brothers, whose other conceptions and beliefs have as much to justify them as mine. Though I am sure of my subjective experience, I must impose on myself every conceivable restriction in interpreting it. I must guard against identifying with my subjective experience. I consider all such identifications as serious psychological mistakes. So it's really trying to pave the way for accepting the plurality of religious experience. I guess when Jung was a young psychiatrist and he had a couple of patients in the ward who thought they were Christ, he would sit them down with each other. It'd be interesting to get people who are absolutely certain of, say, the Muslim view of destroy America and the Christian view we must prevail, put them down in a couple of tables and just have them talk. See what comes out of it. Anne?
The problem with that is you get no discussion. The way you change people's minds is if they think that you're identified with them, they get to like you, and then they realize that you're not identified with them.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's, as a gay person, that's what happens. If people know up front I'm gay, they just automatically don't like me. And if they get to like me, and they have very strong feelings about gay people, and now they like me,
How about any introverts want to say anything?
Yes.
Yeah, Carol. That's a very good point. So it emphasizes the importance of eros in this collision of cultures. Sandy? I think it's eros. Yeah. I would say, now stepping back from our discussion a little bit, where are we going? In other words, we said a threshold of two epochs. Obviously, Jung feels we're starting a new epoch, right? And also felt this was a long-term process, hundreds of years. But if you think about the history, it's not so strange that there would be major shifts. There was a shift from antiquity to Christianity, from Christianity to enlightenment, from kingship to democracy, and I think Jung felt we're in another one of those periods of transitions. From what, it's easier to say, power, to what, it's not so easy to say. I would say, at least to use some words, that eros and meaning take the place of what power now serves. Yes, Tina.
I took a legal class for a little while, but they were talking about why law has changed over time, how we've enacted more laws. It's because of the familiarity that people have. It's like, well, you know somebody who's had an abortion, or you know somebody who's been pregnant who didn't want to be pregnant, or you know somebody who's gay. And you kind of like what Anne was saying, once you realize that you know people who kind of don't fit into what you thought was, then you start shifting towards changing laws. So my point is kind of what I am saying, that do you think that's what we're going to head into then, globally, in a more religious manner? Or like right now we're having problems with Muslims or Al-Qaeda and all this stuff. Do you think eventually we're going to start somehow connecting, because we are connecting in many ways, economically anyway?
Oh, you're not kidding.
Kind of like, if you understand, people aren't so worried about where everybody's believing, they only care about the economy right now. But if that's right down to it, it's money that kind of changes the world in a way.
It's the global mythology of the economy.
Right.
Well, and that's exactly what's happening, because we're moving from a vertical dynamic, which is what power is, power over, to a horizontal dynamic, the network. And in a vertical dynamic, you succeed by taking from someone else. It's or surface power. In a network is only as strong as its weakest link. So in a network, it's about shared power, and you have, literally, if you take from somebody else, you undermine yourself. And so, and we're seeing this now happening in this global financial thing. people, you know, the bank of so-and-so goes off and does X, and then, oh my God, you know, by 3 o'clock it turns out that they, you know, the consequences of that. So it's like we've become tied to one another without knowing it, and now the consciousness of that tie is now having to be absorbed. And in a network, you have to work, you not only have to work with somebody else, you have to work for their success. It's like in the body, you know, you can't, the stomach succeeds by helping the brain, not by diminishing it. And
yeah, that's right, I think.
That's a totally different point, but you consciously know, I have to work for your success to guarantee mine. That's a totally different point of view.
And is that why Doug was saying that he's seeing that he saw a shift back in the 50s or 60s? Mm-hmm. Because we started getting global economy more in the 80s. Mm-hmm. But I mean, he was ahead of time.
Way ahead, yeah.
And he can see where this was going to go.
Yes, definitely.
So it's almost like, and I know I'm bringing in financial parts to this too.
That's important.
I'm not really as much in the religious or the psychology part of this.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm seeing a shift here that maybe this is all tied in together, and if I need to do business, you're a Jew and you're whatever, mm-hmm. I guess I have to kind of overlook that a little bit. Well, I'm just saying. I mean, if you're a doctor and I need medical attention, I guess I can't be too picky about what the economy
is. I think you guys are, I mean, I don't think we can say totally what it will look like, but I think everything you're saying is our relevant ingredients. Going from win-lose to win-win, going from judgment to tolerance, going from power to relationship, from singularity to plurality. I think all of these are ingredients.
The problem is right now we're stuck in the middle, so there's both.
Right. Well, he says between two epochs, so we're right in the middle. The old hasn't died, and the new hasn't been born.
But we don't want to give up our power.
And we do not want to give up our power.
And that's where
we're from. But literally, as every day, this is happening because this world thing, you know, the banks are now having to work together, the governments are having to give up power to do things that they have never given up before. So, I mean, it is literally happening as we speak, as this workshop is happening. And it's like each day, another level of power has to be given up to figure out what's the next thing. I mean, you know, we're watching it happening, like, you know, day by day.
Gary, isn't our whole system based on a love of money in a way? I mean, money is our God.
Power.
In so many ways. So that's Eros coming in.
Yeah,
the other thing is that, you know, when you were talking, it seems to me that the model of quantum energy and concept, you know, if you use that as the metaphor, the story to take all this and put it in, then you can see where it's going into complexity, which is when you're in it, and we are in it, you can't see it, and you have no idea where you're going, you just know you're in something more
mm-hmm.
crazy. But it's that whole, that's almost like a fairy tale, using the quantum science as the fairy tale, the story.
We're going to get there, that the same shift we're seeing in religion, both Jung and Pauli saw, at least in an incipient way, happening in science. Definitely. Through quantum, the implications of quantum mechanics. Introverts, anything else? Yes?
It just occurred to me that it seemed like there's a similarity in your own individual group where you move from, I mean, this is the way it is to this is my understanding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So Jung is really extrapolating from his view of individuals to how this might look in a whole mass of individuals, definitely. And I think he feels at the moment the best we can do is our own individual shift. Though we can talk about that. There might be another step, but anything else, introverts? Okay, you've got the basic idea. I've just given you some other quotes that are going to restate the main point. And so if you go to page 2. Um, In the individuation process, the ego is brought face to face with an unknown superior power, which is likely to cut the ground from under its feet and blow consciousness to bits. All talk of this opponent is mythology. Excuse me. All statements about the ultimate are anthropomorphisms. We'll talk about those words. However interesting or enthralling metaphysical statements may be, I must still criticize them as anthropomorphisms. Here the theologian buttonholes me, asseverating, which means declaring, that his anthropomorphism is God, and damning anyone who criticizes any anthropomorphic weaknesses, defects, and contradictions in it as a blasphemer. Anthropomorphism is... Now, let me just back up a second. I think you probably know this, but I'll just say it. Jung's understanding is that all experience is shaped by our... It sounds silly to even say it, but by our capacity to experience. In other words, the archetype. There are human structural capacities to the personality which are responsible for the way we experience. And that is the way I experience you, the way I experience the clock, the way I experience the light. And it is certainly true in the way I experience God, that the experience of God is shaped by human capacities for perception. So that in our describing our religious experience, we are really describing our experience, which is shaped by our experience-shaping capacities. So the statements of God, it's another way of saying statements of God, are statements about my own personality. So the way I experience God is shaped by who I am. That's an anthropomorphism. That is seeing God in terms of my own personality, because that's the only way I know to conceive.
And would you say, do your own personality and also do an archetypal structure
by,
that is not personal?
By the real correct thing would be to say that all experience is shaped by archetypes. Certainly it is shaped, certainly religious experience is shaped by archetypes. So that in hearing about descriptions of religious experience, you are hearing about the archetype which is shaping it. And that is, has been at least culturally, a culturally relative phenomenon. In other words, the way the Hindus describe God, the way the Christians describe God, the way Muslims describe God, is by virtue of their personality which is describing them. And because they have a different archetypal configuration, their experience of God is described in typically culturally predictable ways. But that the description that they're giving that God is a description of their receptors for that experience as much as anything that has been perceived. And Jung simply says, I want you to take responsibility for that. I want you to take responsibility for the fact that your human personality is reflected in your statements of what God are. And what a theologian, you know, I think even a liberal theologian, if they're subjectively identified with their experience, will say, well, you're just anthropomorphizing experience. You're just anthropomorphizing God, Jung. And Jung is saying, no, you're anthropomorphizing God. I'm simply trying to take account of the fact that we describe God in terms of our own metaphors. And that's as good as we can do. Kathy?
How does that one capacity to perceive God
that affects how we see God? Same way. Yeah.
So if you were to see God as Yahweh, you may sin. Is Yahweh in it?
Well, I think it depends on how strong your filters are. That, yes, there will be a cultural layer to your experience, but then I think one of the goals of our work is to distinguish what of your experience of the self is culturally shaped, to free it up so that it has other avenues of expression. I don't think you'll ever get to the point where you will have an experience of the self that has never been documented somewhere in some religious tradition. But yeah, one of the goals is that your self is not locked into a particular tradition.
Then, Gary, do you see that potential then of shifting between different cultural experiences and then having the understanding of other people coming?
Yeah, definitely.
Cultural.
Yeah,
friends.
Yeah, because if you know, if you've had a dream of Allah, say, who has appeared in a very positive and helpful way, and you know, that's not untypical these days for people to dream of Allah, you're much less defensive to a Muslim.
Mm-hmm. There's something else along the personality types with this, because they're different in terms of the like the Myers-Briggs types, different types, particularly the big difference between sensei and intuition is that intuition tends to have a more ease with multiplicity than the sensei. Sensei tends to be more focused and unitary. I mean, I'm not saying no concrete, mm-hmm. but intuition by its own process is open to many more things. And so individually, different people are open more or less to multiplicity, and then even cultures. You know, that's very much. And then my experience has been is that people who are more open to multiplicity then embrace things more easily, whereas the people who are less open, they have to be, you know, the bomb has to drop on them. You know, maybe something, if their self is wanting them to open up, they may have to have a more extreme life experience to be able to get that to enter.
Okay. So you okay with that? These kind of new words that have popped up here, anthropomorphism? Everyone okay with that?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about someone who, say, is raised in a very strong religious culture,
yeah,
but has very different views? You know, is that, I mean, their culture shapes them, but their view is odd one.
They'd probably get into Jungian analysis, I'd imagine. Pardon?
They're probably
here. We've got all of them, all 15 of them in the world. Well, that would probably be, I mean, if the person is really true to their religious feeling and open, they would probably become a leader. If they can stand it. Should we have a stretch?